From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I don't remember exactly when I started cooking, but there is a photograph of me as a girl standing at the stove with a splotch of grease on the front of my dress, holding a spatula, my hip cocked, a grown-up look on my face. I've always felt a power larger than myself while cooking. I learned how to cook by saying nothing, watching how each ingredient was managed. But so much of the art of cooking lies in the body. I gained knowledge about the spirit of the cooks who came before me, the rhythm in the way they sloshed the greens in the sink, removed a pot seconds before it burned, drew a knife close enough to the finger to hold the vegetable taut, but never cut themselves. A kind of electric excitement passed through me when I watched Granny cook. Even now, I don't know what to call it, but there was grace and poise in her kitchen dance.
That is the prose you get when you marry a poet to material of her own lineage, with stories and memories of time spent in kitchens and at the stove. In Crystal Wilkinson's extraordinary book, Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, the former poet laureate of Kentucky teases out a complex web of attachment to Black Appalachia and those who came before. I'm thrilled to have Crystal on Good Food. Welcome to Good Food, Crystal.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. It's such a singular book that you've written. And I think I want to start with the first photo in the book, which really grabbed at my heart. It's a scattering of papers, many of which bear the marks that paper gets when it's been folded and unfolded over and over. And the recipes on the papers are handwritten in cursive, many in ink. Mm-hmm. And they're the kinds of splatters on some of the recipes that tell us that someone has followed these directions more than once. Can you tell us about this photograph, maybe a little bit about this particular grouping and your connection to them?
Yes, these are all photographs. I mean, these are all papers written on notebook, lined notebook paper, and some backs of envelopes. Most of them are in a little rusted tin recipe box that I've had since I was a freshman in high school. So I've had them many, many years, and they are well used and well treasured in my grandmother's handwriting, some of them. Some of them are in my handwriting as I dictated a recipe from her.
I love that. It's like, I think these kinds of recipe boxes are getting too often, without much thought, thrown away, which just makes me incredibly sad. Tell us about your home place, the home place of your family.
Well, Indian Creek, at least when I was growing up, was a little up a holler, as the people down home would say. It's nestled off of a back road. You turn off the main highway and you go in there on a gravel road and you cross Green River and you go on up the hill a little bit. And our house set up on another hill up that place. And there was a thriving Black community there at one time. Although I think most of them were relatives, I always talk about that growing up there, I didn't meet any other Black people until after I moved away that weren't relatives in some way. But yes, it's a beautiful, really rich green place. In many, many years, decades even, of our family grew up there.
How long had it been in the family when you were growing up there?
That particular plot of land had been in our family all the way going back since the time of slavery, really. Like, there's different plots that were cut up, but like there was another area across the creek where there's a graveyard, and that graveyard goes all the way back to just right after slavery.
Why do you think that people are surprised to learn that there are Black residents of Appalachia whose ancestors go back these many generations?
I think because of the resounding stereotypes about Appalachia, period, I think people think of, you know, the word rednecks, or they see a particular image that they have gotten off of television or in films. And so they play into the stereotype first. And I think it's a place that they don't expect to find Black people. You know, often the idea of rural and white and urban and Black are still conflated in our realities and in our imagination. So people just don't think that Black people live in those type of areas.
You're both a novelist and a poet, and you've explored what is often called Appalachian life in other works. What called you to step into the kitchen?
Well, I've always been stepping into the kitchen in some ways. And so, you know, in my poetry, in my fiction, food has always been a characteristic of region, of culture, just like accent is culture and geography is culture, ethnicity is culture, so is food. And so in my earlier short stories, in my earlier poems, there's always been a thick layer of food. And this particular iteration started with the birth of an essay. So I wrote an essay called Prairie Song for the Kitchen Ghost. And then the book itself came after that. But I think I see food as sort of a great unifier, that if we talk about our food and our food ways, you know, you can't help but to understand someone else that you know nothing about a little better.
Can you tell us about your grandmother with whom you lived and how she explained to you as a child the importance of female-to-female culinary lineage in your family?
Well, my grandmother, both my grandparents were really quiet people, and I therefore became a very quiet child. So a lot of our time was spent in silence, sort of walking around. But when she sort of, especially when she was cooking and she sort of, you know, looked off into out the window, or, you know, sort of stared at the wall while she was concentrating on what she was doing, she would often tell me a story. And, you know, one of the things that she always said was that she could not quite get things right in comparison to her own mother. And so even as a small girl, I was standing on chairs, you know, sort of peeping over, looking at what she was doing. And I started to think about cooking for myself and, like, you know, how one day when I grow up, I'm going to be able to do this and I'm going to be able to cook.
Could you speak a little bit on how Southern Appalachian foodways differ from those of the larger South, and maybe use your greens as an example of the difference?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the terrain. You know, I often talk about these food fights that we have regionally. Well, I like this, and no, I like this, and don't put sugar in your grits, and, you know, all those kind of things. And those are part of our heritage, you know, the part of the knowledge that's been passed down from our heritage about the way that we eat things. So, for example, the greens that I grew up with in Appalachia were often kale, mustard, turnip greens. They might have some wild green mixed in with them versus collards in the Deep South. Most people in the Deep South have winter gardens, and often collards is something that's in those winter gardens. You can't grow any kind of greens in Appalachia during the winter. So I think that's one way they differ. And then the, you know, Appalachian people have an emphasis on preservation is another way that the food is different. The preparation of meat, instead of having barbecued meat, we might put those hams up to be cured to save for the winter. We would put the potatoes up for the winter. That was one of the things that was my job when I was a girl, to go into the attic and spread the potatoes out either on old newspaper or on a piece of tin my grandfather had put in there and line them up to where they're not piled on top of each other so that they would rot, but you spread them out. And so you have potatoes all winter. And so by the time it's spring planting time, you still have, they might be wrinkled, but you still have edible foods to get you through the cold.
You titled your first book of short stories, Blackberries, Blackberries, and it's also the title of a chapter in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about what these berries connect you to, and then you have to, of course, tell us about biscuits and blackberry soup.
Well, you know, blackberries, while they're wonderful to eat, have a lot of nostalgia and a lot of memory attached for me. It was one of our great summertime activities, even though it's sort of daunting, right? You put on all of this stuff, like in order to go blackberry picking, you had to put on long sleeves in the midst of July. And my grandparents would put coal oil, kerosene around your wrists and around your ankles to stave off chiggers, which were insects that would embed in your skin. You had to watch for copperheads and rattlesnakes, which like to hide in the blackberry brambles. And then wild blackberries have thorns. So this was not an easy task, but we did it every summer, and we would take buckets and pails and dish pans and everything we could to the area, which for us, the best blackberries were on the graveyard. So for me, what I remember too is that it was always a history lesson. You know, my grandfather would say, here's where my brother Andrew is buried. He died when he was 4. Or my grandmother would say, you know, here's where my father is buried, or whoever the relative might be. And a lot of it was done in silence in the sweltering heat, and all you could hear is the plunk of those blackberries hitting the sides of the bucket. And we would eat some, and then we would go home and wash them off and realize we had eaten bugs, which was great. And then my grandmother would start the preservation part. Usually she would make a blackberry cobbler that night, and then she would start canning and freezing berries for, again, to prepare for winter, so that by the time Christmas came along, there would be blackberries to make jam cake with. But one of my favorite things, and I just had it last week with my store-bought blackberries, which were not as good as the wild ones of my childhood, is what I call blackberry soup, which is simply putting blackberries on with a little bit of sugar, letting them boil down, and putting 2 fresh biscuits right in the middle of them.
Just that picture is just such heaven.
It's such a beautiful color, too. There's nothing like that purple, lovely richness. You're making me hungry just talking about it.
You know, the beauty of this book is the way that you describe these moments in time that are so attached to place. And which really just lends so much like flavor to everything, including the food. I'm curious, when you cook now in your kitchen, do you still have tools that your granny used that you took over?
Yes, I do. I have her ceramic mixing bowl that I use, a big yellow mixing bowl, and I feel like my rolls won't rise correctly unless I put them in that bowl. An apron. I have an apron of hers. Like I think it's important. I have some of her glasses that I keep hanging on the wall, like above my banister in my kitchen, so that I can look up and see her glasses and think about her sort of watching me while I cook. You know, I know a lot of people throw things away, like you said earlier, like throwing away the old recipe boxes and things like that. But I think it's important to have something that you can, something tangible that evokes memory for you. I don't have as many things as I used to, but I always keep something around. I also have like among the last green beans that she canned still in a jar. You know, she died in 1994 and she probably had given me those to feed my children because they were all small then. But after she died, I just could not open that last jar. It's the last one that I have. And I just keep it sitting on the counter also as motivation and inspiration.
Thank you so much, Crystal.
Thank you.
That was Crystal Wilkinson, the author of Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, stories and recipes from five generations of Black country cooks. We've got a recipe for her biscuits and blackberry soup on our website. You know the link, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, beets and labneh, grilled carrots with harissa, and a plate of kibbeh. What more does one need? We've got stories and recipes from Maidan next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Maidan, pronounced Maidan, Maidan, or Maidan, doesn't carry a passport, writes Rose Previtt. The word used throughout the Middle East, Central and South Asia, the Caucasus, East Europe, and North Africa means a public meeting place, often in the middle of a city. So it's fitting that Rose named her second restaurant in Washington, D.C., Maidan. And lucky for those of us in LA, she's poised to open a new spot here in Los Angeles. The American-born restaurateur joins us to talk about her Lebanese-Italian heritage, her travels, and why she shifted her lens from public policy to food. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. You studied public policy after getting a taste for travel, and there was a 3.5-week journey that you took on the Trans-Siberian Railroad that gave you a different focus, a new direction. How did you find yourself, so to speak, on this new train to a new career path?
Yeah, that train was very literal and figurative for me at the time. How did I find myself there? It was, there's a chapter in my cookbook. It says, from Russia in love or to Russia in love. And, you know, I definitely landed in 3 years in Moscow unexpectedly, traveling extensively and ending that journey on a 3-week, very epic trip across the country on the Trans-Siberian. But it was kind of the culmination of 3 years of soul searching and, you know, following my husband while he had a really cool job, but also in that process, sort of losing my identity in my early 30s, fresh out of grad school, ready to change the world, and then ending up sort of a 30-year-old housewife unexpectedly. After 3 years of, you know, worrying that I was going to get back to the States and not have a job in my field, I actually just decided, why do I need a job in my field? Maybe I'll flip the script now and do something I'm really passionate about. And that turned into a restaurant career after a master's in public policy.
I love that. So, Rose, your first restaurant, Compass Rose in Washington, D.C., is focused on global street food. What did you want to do at your second restaurant, Maidan, that was different than what you had been doing at Compass Rose?
Compass Rose was really fun, and it still is very fun 10 years in. We still sell tons of international street food from the whole world. But for my second restaurant, I really realized like my soul food, the food that I grew up like having an emotional connection to, is Middle Eastern food, because so many important moments of communication and bonding with my mother and her sisters and my grandmother were over cooking over Lebanese food. And so I really wanted to focus the second restaurant on the cuisine of my cultural background. And, you know, on a practical basis, I love Lebanese food, but I also love food from out the entire region. And I thought we could get a more diverse range of flavor profiles if we actually traveled a little more extensively. So to open Maidan, I took a couple chefs traveling and we did a research trip over 5 countries, Tunisia, Morocco, Lebanon, Turkey, and the Republic of Georgia. And we brought a number of recipes from the home kitchens of women all over that region back to our restaurant. And Maidan, in my opinion, has become, you know, kind of a tribute to many of the women who taught us to cook, like my mother, my grandmother, but also the women who welcomed us into their homes as a lot of unsung culinary heroes, in my opinion, who really never, you know, got credit for cooking and cleaning and raising lots of children in countries where a lot of women aren't permitted to work in restaurants.
So I want to talk about beets, which are in every produce box this time of year and
yes.
don't get enough love. People seem to be stymied by beets. And I'm sure in your Russian travels, you had your fair share. How were you able to fall in love with the vegetable again after being so thoroughly saturated in it?
Yes, it's always interesting to get to a place and realize, you know, some of the things you heard are true. We ate a lot of beets in Russia and a lot of other root vegetables, many of which were amazing, especially the mushrooms. Mushrooms in Russia are unbelievable. But I will say excessive amounts of borscht, especially on the Trans-Siberian Railroad when you possibly want to eat something else but nothing else is available, eventually turn you off to it. It was this recipe for beet biryani that reformed me. It's truly one of our favorite dips. It comes out a beautiful pink color when you mix the beet and the labneh, the yogurt. People love to take Instagram pictures of this dish on top of the fact that it's garlicky and lemony and just absolutely delicious.
It is the perfect dip. And every time I serve it, people are just like, wow, what is that?
Yeah.
So live fire is one of the hallmarks of Maidan. How do carrots fit into cocktails in Lebanon? And how did you integrate that experience into the restaurant menu?
Oh, it's really fun. I mean, the very first time I went to Lebanon as an adult, I sat at like the first, you know, bar we found. It was summertime. It was super hot. And we ordered a drink. I don't even remember if it was alcoholic, but with either alcoholic or non-alcoholic beverages, you get a little snack in Lebanon. And we would get a little cup of carrots in lemon juice as just a snack on, and it was just refreshing. But that flavor profile stayed with us, you know, on every trip that we went to. And so lemon, of course, being just omnipresent in Lebanese dishes, but that carrot and the connection, it was just important. And we wanted to bring memory of food dishes. And this is the same thing we do at Compass Rose. Like everything on the menu has a story behind it. To me, that is in essence, how the culture was passed on from my family to me. It was through storytelling, through cooking, through food, how we got this recipe, why we make it this way. And that was based in how I learned who I was, you know, living in a small town where there were no other Lebanese people. I knew very, very clearly through the food that I made that I was ancestrally Lebanese. So that was really important. So the carrots are just a very simple way of saying this is a tradition in Lebanon. But since we have this giant fire, we're actually going to grill the carrots. And a lot of people tell us the carrot satisfies them as much as a steak by the time it gets off of the fire. We douse it with lemon. We drizzle a somewhat spicy, not overwhelmingly so, harissa on top of it, and is also one of our winter dishes. It's on this time of year. It goes off for the summer when we have more access to vegetables, but it's just like an amazing thing to do in the winter.
You know, we don't talk about lamb very much, or we haven't talked about lamb very much on this show, and I'm really curious, what is your preferred way to eat it?
Oh, I'm the right person. My first solid food was kibinae, which is the raw lamb dish that you can find the recipe for in the book. And I would say, you know, not just because I'm biased because it was my first solid food, but it is still one of my absolute favorite ways to eat the dish. It does require going, at least in my family, we believe you should go to the special, you know, halal butcher who will cut a very lean cut of ground lamb. You can also just get a leg of lamb and trim it yourself and grind it at home. So you don't have to live near a butcher that can do this for you. But if you want to cheat, and if you live in LA, you can easily get the right kind of lamb for this dish. My family recipe, and there's a few adaptations in the book, ours is very simple with onion, salt, and pepper. So we really let the ingredients speak, and we have to use really, really high quality lamb. But there's also a lot of variations with a lot of stronger spices like allspice, ground rose petals. My family in the north of Lebanon actually serves it with a harissa-like sauce on the side. So you add that pepper, olive oil, onion into kind of like a pita bread bite at the end, and that would be probably one of my favorite ways to eat lamb.
Yeah, me too, I have to say. So what are your plans for your spot here in Los Angeles? Do you know where it will be yet?
Yes, we are super excited to be opening on West Jefferson. We are between La Brea and Crenshaw, right across from Highly Likely, which is a great neighborhood spot that's been there since 2017. So we're moving in across the directly across the street.
And is it a restaurant or a marketplace? What form is it going to take?
Yeah, we're calling this spot Maidan Market because I really wanted to bring Maidan kind of anywhere that I live. And I'm fortunate to live between DC and LA, and we've lived in LA for 6 years now. I've admired the food community from afar, but I desperately wanted to be part of it. I have fallen in love with every aspect of the food world here. And just like in DC, this is how I build community, and I wanted to build a community here. And so hopefully that's what happens when this spot gets open. It will be slightly different than the original Maidan because it's bigger. It's a 10,000 square foot space. So that's too much for us. We still just need the back corner. And so there'll be about 140 seats for Maidan in the back corner. One of my favorite things about the space here is that we're bringing in 5 LA businesses that are small businesses, some of whom work out of a food truck right now, some who are desiring a second location, but have not been able to figure out a way to do it. We're trying to kind of lower the barrier to entry for really small businesses. My takeaway from COVID was small businesses, especially small restaurants, are endangered. Like, we made it through by sticking together during COVID. And if we don't help each other going forward, as cities like LA and DC get more and more expensive, we will cease to exist. And so we're hoping to create this kind of collaborative space where we literally share the fire. All the businesses have access to using the fire, the same one that Maidan's using, but they'll represent an array of different countries. But we really want you to like wind and get lost a little bit and like explore the entire space, kind of like you would if you were in a market anywhere else in the world.
Very exciting. Thank you so much, Rose.
It's been amazing talking to you. Thank you for having me.
That was Rose Previtt. She is the owner of Compass Rose and Maidan in Washington, D.C. Her book is Maidan, Recipes from Lebanon and Beyond. We have a recipe for her kibinaya on our website. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Los Angeles has its fair share of Puerto Rican and Cuban spots, but where do you go if you're hungering for a taste of dishes from the Dominican Republic? Writer and ever-curious eater Bill Esparza returns with a look at a restaurant, a food truck, and 2 pop-ups in and around Los Angeles that showcase the cuisine. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you back. Tell us a little bit about the Dominican culture here in LA. How fast is the Dominican population growing in LA?
Well, although it's still a small population, it is the fastest growing, you know, what they say, Hispanic population in California.
I'm curious, are the Dominicans who are coming to LA, this increase in population, do you know, are they coming directly from the Dominican Republic or are they moving from other parts of the U.S. where there have long been larger Dominican populations?
A lot of them are coming from New York. You know, when I was out visiting the Caribbean cuisine food truck, there were some that were saying they're about to move here from New York. And Ilonka, the chef and owner of Caribbean cuisine, she said, it's getting too crowded in New York, so they're all coming out here.
So interesting. So what's the learning curve for Angelenos who are more familiar with Mexican and Central American flavors?
Well, I think for me, one of the things that strikes me about Dominican cuisine, they do all these combinations, you know, where I think Mexican food tends to be a little formal in terms of how we use beans and rice, but they are just like mixing and matching all these wonderful bean and rice dishes and also moros, the beans and rice together, and changing it up with their orders, with their different stews. They have a lot of stew dishes, but it makes for a real flavorful meal. You know, you have really tasty beans, really tasty rice, a stew, and then, you know, a potato salad on the side. And you can kind of make your own combo.
Well, that sounds so good. So who can we find at the wheel of the Caribbean cuisine food truck? What's your background and where is it typically parked?
So Ilonka, I mean, you might have heard of Ilonka before. For a while, she was sort of the only game in town. I know we've had Dominican restaurants come and go over the years, but she first came out in the Camagüey market many years ago. And then she was in some bakery, and then she was in another space and another space. And finally, she has a food truck in Mid-City.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I understand that the menu gets a daily refresh. What staple dishes can you recommend?
Definitely anything guisado. And that's where you're going to get the flavor of the Dominican sofrito, their blend of peppers and spices and culantro that they is the base of their cooking. And then, you know, what Ilonka does is she changes the beans and rice dishes every day because she's got a lot of regulars. But, you know, she also has now every day Tres Golpes, which is the national Dominican breakfast of mangú, the mashed plantains cooked in butter that comes with fried eggs, Dominican salami and fried cheese. She has that every day. She's got a few savories, pastelitos, which are like empanadas, a nice chinola, passion fruit juice, different stews. And then there's also pica pollo, which is like a fried chicken skin.
Mm, wow, so good. So who operates El Bacano in the San Fernando Valley?
Diani Santana and her brother, Jonathan Santana. Diani's the chef, and her brother is front of the house and also, you know, helping her run the business. But they actually have a restaurant background, and they've been at this for a while. And they really came here to Los Angeles with the specific purpose of opening a Dominican restaurant. They were up in Anchorage, Alaska before.
Wow. And is it a brick and mortar?
Yes, it is currently the only brick and mortar that's a Dominican restaurant in Los Angeles.
Fantastic. And I understand they're relying on their grandmother's original recipes.
Yes. And it's really, you know, they're showing their background. You know, they've been in restaurants, and the plating and everything is very, you know, almost contemporary. It's very beautiful. It's a great presentation of the cuisine.
And what should we order here?
You know, everybody loves, I want to see, doesn't everybody love Orange Julius?
Oh God, I miss Orange Julius.
Well, we all love Orange Julius, and yes, we miss Orange Julius. So the morir soñando, which is to die dreaming, is a sweet milk and orange juice that's so popular in the Dominican Republic. And so you got to get that. This is also the only restaurant in town you're going to find one of the iconic street food dishes from República Dominicana, which is the chimi burger, which is a beef patty with slaw on it. That's, you're going to find it, you know, you would find it street stands all over the Dominican Republic. And at all these restaurants, another term that's used for these different kind of combo plates is just bandera, which is, you know, meat, rice, and beans. So, you know, you're always getting the Dominican flag in a lot of these dishes. It's a meat with rice and beans. And I think when you get into Central America and the Caribbean and even South America, rice and beans become so much more flavorful, and they become a main dish where they're not a main dish in Mexico. They're more of a side dish in most of the cuisines. But here, it's a main dish.
And I understand that there are also two Dominican pop-ups. What are they and where are they?
Well, you have the Dominicans, which is in downtown LA. The Dominicans has a short menu. I think you can get his food on DoorDash. He'll just have a couple of items each day. And again, you're going to have different guisados, guisada dishes, carne guisada, pollo guisado. And then you have El Coro Cafe, which translates to the hangout. And what I like about that spot is he's bringing some of the fun comfort dishes that you would only find in New York, like Dominican lasagna and also Dominican spaghetti, which incorporates some of the Dominican salami and longanisa into the spaghetti.
Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
That was writer Bill Esparza. For a link to his Eater LA story about the moment Dominican food is having in Los Angeles, head to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, sure, you know about sake, but what about shochu? At 24% ABV, it's great over ice with a spritz of lemon or mixed into a low-alcohol cocktail. We've got everything you need to know about the Japanese spirit next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Last time I spoke with Courtney Kaplan, she and her partner, Charles Namba, opened Ototo, a sake bar next door to their popular izakaya restaurant, Tsubaki, just down the hill from Dodger Stadium in Echo Park. Courtney is known as a sake-sam, and last year they took home the James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Wine and Other Beverages Program. Today, Courtney explains shochu, perhaps a lesser-known spirit here, but in Japan, it's more popular than sake. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Evan.
What is the difference between sake and shochu?
They're quite different. The main difference is in the production. Sake is fermented, so it's probably closest to beer in the way that it's brewed, whereas shochu is distilled, so it's a spirit, and it can be made from a variety of different base ingredients. Sake is always made from rice, whereas shochu can be made from barley. It can be made from rice. Often it's made from sweet potato. You even see some versions made from sesame or with ginger or carrot. So the variety of base ingredients is much broader than it is with sake. But the main difference really is the distillation of the product.
And is it correct to say that the Korean soju is an equivalent?
So they're similar but different. They share the same characters, which just basically mean distilled spirit. So they're pronounced quite similarly, and I'm not an expert in Korean soju, so my knowledge is quite limited. But my understanding is that Korean soju is often distilled multiple times to create a really clean drinking experience, sort of like vodka, is often multiple distillations, whereas Hongkok shochu, which is the shochu that we serve at Ototo, is single distillation. So you really taste the base ingredient underneath. You really taste if it's made from sweet potato, you really taste the sweet potato. If it's made from rice, you really taste the rice of it. They're both distilled spirits, and they probably originate from similar sort of innovations in distillation technology, but they do drink and operate quite differently.
Are there regulations pertaining to shochu in terms of how it's made?
So in order to be considered Hongkok shochu, it does have to go through only one single distillation. There is another category of shochu called Otsuri shochu, which is multiple distillation. So that is a primary difference in the category, depending on what you're going to be using it for. If you're going to be sipping a shochu where you really want that base ingredient to shine, you're going to want to look for the Hongkok shochu, where oftentimes the multiple distilled product is more suitable for mixing or for using in cocktails. So that is a relatively strict regulation that you will see on the label of shochu.
And why are we only now starting to see it more frequently here in the U.S.?
You know, that's a really great question because it's been popular in Japan for quite a long time. I worked at a restaurant in New York in the early 2000s, and they actually branded their bar as a shochu bar because all of our Japanese chefs, that was what they preferred to drink, and they thought that New Yorkers would take to it as well. And it just sort of, I think it's a complicated beverage for folks to understand, possibly because of the confusion with Korean soju. I do think there is more of an interest in it now. I hope the interest is because it's such a compelling beverage. I think it really is, shows fascinating flavor profiles. It typically clocks in around 25% alcohol by volume. There are some that are higher and some that are lower, but it's a great opportunity to make a cocktail that perhaps is a little bit lower ABV, which I know a lot of people are looking for these days. But it just has a really unique place in the world of spirits that you can't really replace with anything else. And I think for many years, it was often used as a substitute for restaurants that didn't have a full liquor license, because you are able in California to buy shochu under a beer and wine license. And it would often get plugged into sort of what we would think of as a traditional cocktail. But I think today folks are really now embracing it, shochu for what it is, and developing cocktails to really let it shine on its own.
So talk to us a little bit about that, about how it's best consumed. For example, can you drink it either hot or cold as you would sake? And is it something to be sipped, or do people drink shots? How is it best enjoyed?
In my experience, there's not a huge culture of shot drinking in Japan, although I'm sure there's definitely people in places where that's possible, but it is usually sipped. The classic ways of drinking it in Japan would be, you could drink it neat, you could drink it over ice, you could drink it with a little bit of water called mizuwari, or if you wanted to drink it warm, you do what's called oyuwari, where it's mixed with hot water. So you wouldn't, I don't often see shochu on its own just warmed, perhaps because of the higher alcohol content, but oftentimes it'll be mixed with hot water and then drunk that way, maybe with a squeeze of lemon or a little bit of umeboshi, the Japanese pickled plum inside, as a really kind of classic, simple ways of drinking it. It's also the base ingredient in a whole style of cocktails called chuhai, which is an abbreviation for shochu highball. And it's shochu mixed with fruit juices, or often oolong tea for an oolong high is very classic. And that's, you know, kind of the staple izakaya drink all across Japan is the chuhai.
And is that how you're serving it?
So right now we are serving our version of a chuhai. We change it seasonally depending on what we're finding at the market. So right now we're offering it with mandarin orange and a ginger syrup with a barley shochu. We also always serve it kind of on its own. So we have usually about 10 to 15 types of shochu from all different base ingredients that guests are welcome to choose how they'd like to enjoy it. We offer it neat, over ice, or oyuwari with hot water as well as an alternative for people who really want to enjoy it kind of in its pure form.
You have these different varieties on offer. Are there certain base ingredients that people seem to be drawn to more than others?
I think that for people who are just getting into shochu, oftentimes rice is a really nice gateway because it does share some aromas and flavors with sake, and it tends to be on the more delicate, sort of elegant side of shochu. I think that often we find people who are big brown spirits drinkers or who like agave spirits can often gravitate towards sweet potato shochu, which is made from these special sweet potatoes grown in Kyushu that are often kind of spicy and earthy, can have a smokiness to them as well in shochu form, that we do find that oftentimes people who appreciate mezcal will really enjoy a glass of sweet potato shochu. And then we also have some that are oak barrel aged that sort of do give a whiskey-like drinking experience, although quite a bit lighter. So we will often our first question when people are starting to explore shochu is to find out what kind of other spirits they like to drink and then make a recommendation from there.
So if I came, I would say that I'm a gin drinker.
I would say we would probably start with a really clean aromatic rice shochu served over ice, maybe with a little lemon or lime twist for you.
And how much stronger is shochu than sake?
So sake averages about 15% alcohol, and the shochu that we serve is all 24% alcohol. So it is stronger, but compared to something like a gin or a vodka, which would probably be closer to 40% typically, it is still lighter than what we think of as our average Western distilled spirit.
That's so interesting. And what foods are best paired with it, do you think?
It depends on the style of shochu you're drinking. The sweet potato shochus, they're coming from Kyushu, where the food is pretty hearty, pretty rich, and often a little bit on the sweeter side. So things like braised pork belly or really rich kind of stews go really well with sweet potato shochu, especially at this time of year. If you're kind of for lighter, fresher foods, I think rice shochu can be a really nice choice with them, things that are kind of more neutral. And then barley, which is probably the most neutral of all of them, just has this very pleasant kind of grain-like aroma and flavor, I think is really versatile, and you can probably take it through your whole meal. Oftentimes when I go out with Japanese friends, they'll just order a bottle of barley shochu for the table, some sliced lemon on the side, and we just drink that throughout from sashimi all the way through till the very end. So it is a really versatile drink at the table.
If we want to include it in our home bar, do you have a few favorite brands you could recommend?
So the one that we probably personally drink the most of is a unique shochu called Beni Otome, which is made with sesame. They claim on their back label that they are the only alcoholic beverage in the world that's made from sesame. I don't know for certain if that's true, but they're laying claim to it. And it really has this really beautiful, like, roasted sesame aroma to it. I love that just over like a big ice cube. That's what I sometimes will have at the end of the night at home, just on its own or with like a little kind of, you know, maybe some toasted nuts or something to go with it. I think if we're looking for a really great introduction to shochu for something quite elegant, I would recommend Torikai, which is a rice shochu that's made using sake grade rice that's been heavily polished. So it's really refined, really elegant, and just delicious. Kind of, you could stir it over ice and then pour it into a kind of a cocktail glass and almost drink it like a martini. It's just really clean and clear. And then if you wanted to really get down and try some of the sweet potato shochu, anything from the line of Hozan shochus, I think, are wonderful. They make a line of several different shochus, all made using different colors of koji. So they all have unique flavor profiles, but they're sort of considered to be the gold standard of sweet potato shochu. So I would start with something from Hozan.
And are there particular bottle shops you could recommend where we're likely to find some of these brands?
The best place really that I've seen for shochu is the Japanese supermarkets. So Mitsuwa or Nijiya or Tokyo Central, particularly if you take the trip to Gardena or Torrance, to the big Japanese markets down there, they usually have a very wide selection of lots of brands. So that's where I would recommend starting.
So recently there was a law passed here in California, a labeling law surrounding shochu. Can you tell us what it is regarding?
Yeah, so up until very recently, we were only allowed to carry Japanese shochu on a beer and wine license, which is different from a full liquor license that allows for spirits, if the label said soju on it and it was 24% ABV or less. And, you know, shochu already has an identity problem and it is already always being confused with Korean soju. So the fact that the label had to say soju was a huge source of confusion for consumers for an already complicated beverage. So there was a bill passed this year that now allows shochu to be sold in bars and restaurants that have a beer and wine liquor license, which is really, really wonderful news for us. It, first of all, will help the consumer understand what they're getting in the bottle. And there were quite a few distilleries in Japan that didn't want to write soju on their label because their product is not soju. So we were never able to carry them in our restaurant because of the labeling issue. So my hope is that now with this new law, we will actually be able to carry some new brands that prior were off limits to us.
That's so exciting. Well, thank you so much, Courtney. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
That's Courtney Kaplan. We've been talking about shochu. She and her partner, Charles Namba, won the James Beard Foundation Award for Outstanding Wine and Other Beverages Program for their Echo Park Spot Ototo. Market Report is on deck, so stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's that time when we head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what's in season this second week of March in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. For years now, I have seen Daniel Matteau at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market with his blue wagon full of produce. Daniel is the Grenoble-born chef behind Maison Matteau, a charming little sandwich shack on Melrose in Hollywood. And I'm excited to finally figure out what's in this blue wagon. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. So what are you shopping for today?
Today I'm going to get some eggs. I'll get some broccoli, some citrus, some fennel, just stuff to go in our sandwiches.
I'm so curious about this because your menu is pretty tight. It's mostly just maybe 4 or 5 sandwiches, a few sides. How do you incorporate the seasons into such a small menu?
So I always have a vegan option. So that one always changes with the seasons, and it allows me to be creative. And then I have a couple of sides where I'm able to make some changes too. And then I have one sandwich, which is the Brazola sandwich. And so the meat stays the same, but then I'll change the set with the seasons.
Okay, so let's talk about the vegan sandwich. What's on it right now?
Right now it's butternut squash. So it's just roasted butternut laying on a bed of salad that's dressed in vinaigrette. And then underneath that is a puree of capers and a little bit of espresso and topped with pickled sea beans.
Ooh, tell us about the sea beans.
So sea beans are a succulent. They grow close to the sea and have like a salty aspect to them. And then I just marinate them in vinegar and gives them, a nice punch.
And they're kind of crunchy, right?
Yeah, they are. Uh-huh.
And what about the texture of the butternut squash? Does it end up being soft, or are you able to kind of give it a bite?
So I roast it very hard, and what that does is that it caramelizes the outer part. So I cut them into spears that have like a triangular shape to them. So the top gets almost burnt, and it kind of develops like a skin on it. So the inside and the bottom part is soft, but then there is a little bit of like a chewier part to it.
Sounds delicious. So you mentioned you're shopping for citrus as well. What are you shopping for right now?
Grapefruit.
And how are you going to serve it?
So the grapefruit dish has been on the menu seasonally for like the past 2 years, and it's a half a grapefruit cut into segments, and then I spread a caper sauce on top, a little bit of celery leaf oil, a couple leaves of tarragon, and then it's bruleed with condensed milk. And on top of that, we put cocoa beans that we candied.
That sounds incredible.
There's a lot going on.
What was the inspiration for that dish? There's a, like you said, there's a lot going on.
Sometimes it's hard to put a finger on where an idea came from. I know like grapefruit and celery will go really well together. So maybe that's where it started. And then I kind of wanted to get a salty component. So the capers worked well for that. And can't recall exactly how it all came together, but it just worked.
So great. Well, I love seeing your tiny sandwich shop thriving. It's great to see you here at the market. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Daniel Matteau, the chef and owner behind Maison Matteau on Melrose in Hollywood. The shop is open every day except for Wednesday when Daniel comes here to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. I'm talking now with Letty Garcia of Garcia Organic Farms in Fallbrook. And Letty's the farmer that grows the grapefruit that Daniel was just talking about. Letty, I see 3 varieties on your table today. Tell us what you've got.
So we have Valentine Pomelo, Texas Ruby Star, and Cocktail. Cocktail and Valentine Pomelo are very similar in taste. The Valentine Pomelo is a cross of a pomelo and blood orange. That's why it has a red tint to it. It usually does come around Valentine's Day. It has less seeds than the cocktail. The cocktail is also a cross of an orange and a grapefruit. Therefore, it's so super sweet. It does have a lot of seeds, but it's super juicy. People that come to our stand and say, I don't really like grapefruit, I say, try this one because you won't even taste the grapefruit flavor because all the sweetness of the half orange and half grapefruit makes up for it. And kids love it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Believe it or not, kids will be like, I don't like grapefruit. Once they try the cocktail, it's so sweet that they do. And then the Texas Ruby Star is pink flesh, very strong in flavor. So if you like grapefruit, that's the one that you should go for because that one is a grapefruit flavor.
Yes, yes. That one reminds me of like the grapefruit half that my parents would eat when I was a kid growing up for breakfast. So what is the difference between a grapefruit and a pomelo?
The pomelo is just a pomelo is more of a eating grapefruit, not super juicy. And then different varieties of grapefruit like cocktail and Valentine's are both very, very juicy. But pomelo is more of an eating grapefruit.
And yeah, I've noticed that the pomelos have a much thicker rind.
Yes. We also grow another one, but we don't have it now. It's the Chandler pomelo.
And tell us about that one.
Chandler pomelo is very thick skin. It does have a pink flesh. It is a Chinese grapefruit. And very large in size.
And are we in peak grapefruit season right now?
Yes. Peak for the cocktail and the Texas Ruby Star, but Valentine Pomelo is almost done. This is probably our last week. We grow 6 varieties, and we still have the Mellow Gold coming. Oro Blanco just ended. Okay. And now we're going to have Mellow Gold, and Texas Ruby Star will go on for about another 2 months, along with the cocktail.
And once we get these grapefruit home, how should we be storing them? Do we put them in the fridge?
So for the thick skin, like the pomelo, which is the Valentine pomelo, Chandler pomelo, Oro Blanco, Mellow Gold, those have very thick skin. So those should be okay just to be in the counter if you're going to eat them within the next week or so. But the cocktail grapefruit has very thin skin. Those I would store in the fridge.
Wonderful. Thank you, Letty.
Thank you.
That was Letty Garcia of Garcia Organic Farms. She's at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Market each week. She's also at the Saturday Pico Market, the Sunday Main Street Market, and Sunday in Mar Vista. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush, Nick Lamponi, Phil Richards, and Sue Margulies. And a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I ended up going to have lunch at the Caribbean food truck after my conversation with Bill Esparza, and I highly recommend you do the same. Get a mini bowl with rice, beans, plátanos, and a nice braised protein of your choice. So good. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click on newsletter to sign up. I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.